I'm Morgan Springer from Next and the New England News Collaborative. Female husbands. For nearly 200 years, this term was used to describe individuals assigned female at birth who chose to live fully as men. From the 1700s to early 1900s, the British and American press wrote about female husbands, often in a salacious and sensationalized way. When a female husband's assigned gender was revealed, they were usually detained by police and run out of town. Jen Mannion captures these lives in Female Husbands, A Trans History. It's a book that came out this spring. Jen is a historian and professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts, and they join me to talk about their book. Jen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So I just gave a rather simplistic description of female husbands, but let's fill that out a bit. Who were female husbands historically?
Well, female husbands, as you said, were people who were assigned female at birth, who for any number of reasons, usually when they were teenagers, decided to transgender and live as men. And they became female husbands because they also entered into romantic legal marriages with women. This category of female husband circulated, as far as I can tell, for nearly 200 years in the press, usually when such people were outed as having been assigned female at birth.
So I want to zoom in on one of those accounts that you write about in the book. It's James Howe, who was the most popular female husband of the 18th century in Britain. Tell us their story.
Yeah, James Howe is remarkable because there are so many records left behind about their life. And so James Howe, as far as we can tell, came from a poor family. And James, together with a childhood friend, as teenagers, really decided, you know what, we want to be together. We want to build a life together. And so that's the moment when James transgender and lived as a man. And the two got legally married outside Fleet Prison in London and ran a number of taverns for decades. As far as we can tell, pillars of the community, regular churchgoers, leaders in, you know, local government, respected citizens by all.
And so James Howe was ultimately blackmailed by somebody who claimed to have known them as a child, and James chose to reveal that they had been assigned female at birth. But the response from the community in many ways was positive, which appears to be atypical for the time. Why do you think that was?
James already had decades of friendships and respect and goodwill in the community. And so I think that's a really important part of the story. But then the other part of the story, which I think was probably sad for James, is that they felt like in order to get people to listen and to really understand their side of the story, that they actually had to present as female. And so famously, when they go to court to testify about their blackmailer, they do put on a typical attire that women wore at the time. They subjected themselves to kind of a voluntary ungendering in order to be heard. And so it's definitely not a story of, you know, complete respect and acceptance that, you know, I think we wish was the case.
There was a shift in how female husbands were portrayed in historical articles over time that you capture in the book. What were the big changes you observed?
So in the 18th century, female husbands are written of as men. They may have been assigned female at birth, but once they transgender and legally married women, they are treated as men. And as time goes on, you see that eroded. By the mid-19th century in the U.S. especially, there becomes a more antagonistic, mocking tone towards female husbands. And this coincides with the rise of the women's movement and feminism. And so you see the beginning of this argument that female husbands aren't men, they're not husbands, they're really women who want to be men. And so previously we see a distinction between sex and gender. I can be assigned female at birth, but I can live as a man in society. And 100 years later, that gets collapsed.
I had this question while I was reading the book, and maybe what we're talking about right now is the answer to that. But I was wondering, you know, were there ways that you found more progress in the lives and communities surrounding female husbands in the time periods you were researching than, say, the 20th century or even today?
Definitely. I think the key issue here is the question around feminism and women's rights. As long as women were second-class citizens and were really no threat in terms of having political power or economic independence, the idea that someone assigned female might want to live as a man, well, it wasn't respectable. It wasn't celebrated, but it also wasn't the worst thing. It could be tolerated. And it made sense in the 19th century because everyone knew that, you know, to live as a woman was to be someone who made terrible wages, had little autonomy, and, you know, no political voice. Once women became more of a threat in terms of making claims to equality or sameness with men in these other arenas, then suddenly people who are female husbands were threatening. And you see this emerge in some of the discussion in the later 19th century, that this could not be tolerated because, as one writer said, you know, if women could choose to marry female husbands, then they might have no use for men.
To write this book, you read stories written by the press at the time and fictional accounts of female husbands. What was that like to read those accounts?
It was complicated. So it was so exciting just to see in old newspapers stories about people grappling with gender, resisting gender norms, choosing, you know, unconventional relationships and in some cases same-sex desire. So on the one hand, it's just so exciting to read about people in the past who are having feelings and thoughts that I myself could relate to, because that's so often not the case. On the other hand, every story at least had some negative, judgmental tone about the person. So in that way, it can be emotionally exhausting and, you know, really challenging, especially for those of us who are members of and identify with the trans community, to read this constant ongoing, you know, critique and belittling of people like you or people who share some of your own feelings and experiences.
And you're able to take these stories that are written in that way and bring that sort of emotion and transform them in a lot of ways into something different. Can you talk about the intentional ways you wrote differently than the accounts in the press?
That's definitely probably the hardest part of this book, but I feel like the most important part. The trans community and our friends and allies deserve access to our history. You know, we deserve to have the opportunity to grapple with how people thought about gender and gender nonconformity in the past, but without subjecting ourselves so much to, you know, blanket negative, hostile language. And so my balance was to use language and methods that are trans-affirming in the present as I and my community understand them. But also as a historian, I would never change an original document. You know, you just don't do that and you can't do that. And so sometimes the book does quote passages that might be hard for some people to read.
And you're also not assuming the motive for transing gender, right? And you made this very intentional choice to not assume gender or sexuality and use the they, them, their pronouns.
Rather than do further injustice and try to guess or make up intention to fit something, I took the approach to say, you know what, maybe that's actually not the most important question for us to try to answer. And instead, let's try to answer all the other ones, you know, like what they did and how it was received and then how they reacted. I think one of the consequences of this is that the book tries to also open up space to allow for any number of contemporary people who might identify as transgender or butch or aggressive or lesbian to say, you know what, I could have been one of these people, or I really relate to that. And that the specific identity category that I hold now maybe is less relevant because it's 200 years ago. It doesn't easily translate back anyway, which is to say that some of us who think we are really different might actually have more in common than we realize.
Jen Mannion is a historian, author of the book Female Husbands, A Trans History, and a professor at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Thank you so much for talking about your book, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me.
Listen to Next on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.